Water Public Radio is supported by the IT Doctors, a ZenCorp company, IT professionals specializing in extending your existing technology into the world of e-business, on the web at it-doctors.com. Good morning and welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Melanie Summer, sitting in today for Catherine Lanfer. We're going to be talking this morning about redistricting of congressional lines in the state of Minnesota in the wake of the census numbers that were released yesterday. But we'd also like to start out by telling you that we expect President George W. Bush to have a news conference right around 9:30 this morning. And so when that begins, we will take that live coverage and hear what the president has to say. But for now, we will talk about the census, which could have some big implications for the makeup of the state's congressional delegation, primarily in the Twin Cities metro area. The population of the suburban districts has grown dramatically over the past 10 years, while the population of the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul has grown more slowly. That means we expect a big fight over redrawing of congressional district lines when the legislature takes up that task later this year. The state's Republican Party is already floating the idea of creating just one district to cover both the Twin Cities. Democrats oppose that idea. We'll talk this morning with representatives of both of those major parties. Bill Walsh, the state Republican Party's communications director, is in the studio with me this morning. Mr. Walsh, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And Mike Erlinson, who is the chair of the state DFL party, is on the line on the telephone from Washington, D.C. Mr. Erlinson?
Good morning, Melanie. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to get general reaction from the two of you gentlemen about the census figures released yesterday. There didn't seem to be too many surprises, although, as I mentioned, there was some population growth in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, much greater growth in the suburban areas around that. Mr. Walsh, let's start with you.
Well, there wasn't much surprise in the census figures. The growth has occurred in Minnesota in the 11-county kind of metro suburban ring. Most of the population has moved out of the most of the growth has occurred in the ring, coming from outstate Minnesota and coming somewhat from the core cities. So when we get to redistricting, what we really need is a fair plan that will recognize that growth and that shift.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Erlinson, were there any surprises for you?
No, I would pretty much agree with what Bill said. I mean, the one thing to note, though, I mean, this is really actually in the grand scheme of things, it's good news for Minnesota because the population has grown in the state quite substantially. You know, even while the 4th and the 5th District, for example, Minneapolis and St. Paul's core cities, need to pick up some population, those two cities did continue to grow. So the overall picture is for the Minnesota as a Midwestern state that grew instead of shrank, like so many of our neighbors, is good news. It's good news for our economy. And ultimately, you know, the battle that we'll see take place at the legislature on redistricting is something that's always fun to talk about and fun to watch every 10 years. But it's a very important piece that needs to take place, and you know, my hope certainly is that Steve Swigum, the Speaker, and Roger Moe, the Majority Leader in the Senate, and Governor Ventura will ultimately sit down and agree to plans for both the congressional seats as well as the Minnesota legislature and actually get that job done without having it done by the courts.
Well, we can talk about that particular question in a little bit, but let's talk, first of all, Mr. Walsh, about the suggestion that you made yesterday of instead of having St. Paul and Minneapolis represented right now by two different members of Congress in two different districts, that you think now is the time to put both of the cities into one district. Why is that?
Well, again, it's about recognizing the growth that has occurred. Right now in the 11-county suburban ring, we have 45% of the state's population lives in that suburban ring. And currently we have two congressmen representing that area. And of course, the Luther district is about 100,000 voters over, and the Ramstead district is about 30,000 voters over. And that's the problem we need to solve with redistricting. The 45% of the population really needs more than two congressmen. It needs at least three, maybe four. One way to do that, and a smart way to do that with the redistricting plan, is to combine the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul into a single urban congressional district, which would allow you to draw at least three suburban districts around the outside. And it keeps the communities of interest together, and it really, if you look at an urban district in the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, they have similar needs. They're both urban cities. They both have transit needs. They both have housing needs. Urban development, health and human services needs that are unique to urban cities across America. And they really need a congressman to work specifically on those issues. Whereas the suburban areas are different. They have, you know, the 6th District, for instance, has the highest number of working families with kids in childcare. We have the highest number of working moms in the country in the 6th District. That's a unique need. And to put a congressman in a position of trying to represent Frogtown with a vote and North Oaks in the same district makes it difficult, and really that needs to be fixed instead of exacerbated.
Mr. Erlinson, what's your response to that? Why does that not make sense to you?
Well, first of all, certainly Congressman Szabo and Congresswoman McCollum do a very good job of not only representing their urban voters, but also their suburban voters. And if you look at the first-ring suburbs that surround Minneapolis to the west and those that surround St. Paul to the east, those suburbs really match up. They're older, little older suburbs, and frankly are much more similar to the core of the city that they butt up against than they are to the larger growing suburbs that have become sort of the second-ring suburbs around the Twin Cities. You also have a situation where if you were to stick Minneapolis and St. Paul, two big urban cities, into the same district, you're also now cutting up Ramsey County and Hennepin County into two more districts, potentially. You're also, on the grand scheme of the state, if you're assuming that you have to have more suburban congressmen or congresswomen, that the city should, in a sense, have the city should have less representation, and ultimately, by doing that, sort of three or maybe four suburban districts, you will take away a voice of rural Minnesota, greater Minnesota, in Washington D.C. Because there's no question we would lose a congressperson or two. That's primarily focused today is on greater Minnesota. So it's a very convoluted thing. I think also the reality is that Minneapolis and St. Paul are two very different cities. And while there might be some similarities between Frogtown and North Minneapolis, they're very different cities. They've grown in different ways. And also you have large and differing minority populations in both Minneapolis and St. Paul who now have a voice in the election of two members of the United States Congress, and they would lose that voice, certainly, if those two districts were put together.
Yeah, can you be more specific about why you think Minneapolis and St. Paul are so different that they can't be represented by one person?
Well, I find it rather interesting. I live in South Minneapolis, and I have a number of friends in St. Paul, and St. Paul people always want to stay in St. Paul. The Minneapolis people always want to stay in Minneapolis, and I'm not sure if it's a historical or cultural barrier that has existed. You know, the Mississippi River, well, it's no question a physical barrier. It has resulted in cities growing up in different ways. You know, St. Paul has become much more of the positive sense of a bedroom community. The downtown of Minneapolis, for example, is a much bigger, more vibrant place, short of the hockey stadium in St. Paul. That's not a negative for St. Paul. It's just a different type of atmosphere that exists between Minneapolis and St. Paul. The cities, for example, are governed very different. And actually, the population of Minneapolis and St. Paul added together with the new numbers would take it up to about 670,000 plus people. So you would have to lop off a chunk of St. Paul or a chunk of Minneapolis into this new congressional district, which also would not make sense and also breaks one of the core rules of redistricting that you're supposed to keep autonomous areas together and attached together. So, there's no question that there's been a historical and a cultural differences in Minneapolis and St. Paul for years. I think that's a positive thing. And again, I think if you just go back to the fact that, you know, I know that while we have two districts that are more urban, we certainly have those urban members of Congress that focus a lot of their attention on their suburban districts. And in fact, Congresswoman McCollum, I actually think, lives in West St. Paul, which is one of the suburbs of St. Paul, yet she's elected to represent both the suburban and urban.
We're talking this morning with Mike Erlinson, who's the chair of the DFL party in Minnesota. He's joining us by phone from Washington, D.C., and also Bill Walsh, the state Republican Party's communications director, is in the studio with us. And we're talking about redistricting of our congressional districts in Minnesota in the wake of the census yesterday, the census figures that were released. They show a fairly dramatic population growth in the suburban and ex-urban areas around the Twin Cities, and a lesser growth in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we're talking about whether or not it makes sense to dramatically change the way those congressional districts look. The Republican Party is suggesting that maybe it's time to have just one congressional district covering both Minneapolis and St. Paul instead of the two that are in place right now. We're wondering what you have to think about that idea. Give us a call at 651 1-800-227-6000 in the Twin Cities area. Anywhere else you're listening, 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Mr. Walsh, before I get to you, let's just review a couple of facts about the redistricting. The ideal size for a congressional district is about 615,000, which is what I've heard that number bandied about. So
right.
When you redraw these lines, each district should have about that number of people. As you mentioned before, the 6th district right now has about 100,000 more than that number, and the 4th and the 5th are each short by between 40 and 50,000,
right,
and that sort of thing. So the response to Mr. Erlinson's concern about Minneapolis and St. Paul being so different that they shouldn't be in the same district.
Well, a couple things. One, they are unique cities, but cities don't get their own congressional seats in the U.S. Congress. We put cities together all over the country and all over the state. Bloomington and Eden Prairie are unique cities with unique cultures and everything else. They're in the same congressional district, and they probably still will be. There's no entitlement to Minneapolis and St. Paul each having their own congressional district. It makes a lot of sense to put them together now. The other thing that Mike said that needs to be commented on is that minorities are a big part of this congressional redistricting plan. And Mike says that minorities are better off with two different representatives, being the core of two different districts, because then they have two different representatives. We don't have a minority congressional representative right now, and it really is condescending. It's typical liberal condescending attitude that we know best for minorities, and we can take care of them in the Democrat Party. As long as we just keep electing Democrats, then minorities will be okay. I think what you're going to see over the next few months in the testimony in front of the House and Senate committees in the state here is minority groups coming in and saying, we want our communities together. We want to maximize the opportunity to put a person of color into Congress. And if you keep splitting us up and exploiting us and using us to elect Democrats here and Democrats there, that's not serving our population. There's a great opportunity. There's the growth of the black population in Minneapolis St. Paul is up to 100,000 now. We can't draw a majority-minority district like other states can do, but we certainly can maximize the opportunity for a minority to get elected to Congress. And I think we need to let the minority group speak for themselves, and we'll hear that in the next few months.
Although 10 years ago or so, when this plan was proposed at that time after that census, the NAACP was not interested in supporting this idea. I'm not sure what their thoughts are right now, but I'm sure we'll
there's no idea that, I'm sorry, Melanie,
go ahead.
First of all, Bill, I think your remarks about being condescending are sort of very out of line, and I won't address it any more than that, and it's sort of disappointing. I think that, that this is not a discussion that's that way, and I think that Melanie has very correct factual information. We will definitely hear from the minority groups in Minnesota. I'm sure they will testify. Some of them may have already at the legislature, and their voice will be heard, and that is a voice that has always been heard in the DFL party and will continue to be, and we're the party that's fought on their behalf. What I was saying is that, as I said before, these are two very different cities. These are two cities that do have unique and growing minority populations. And the minority populations, and as you pointed out, Bill, are not large enough to create a quote-unquote a minority district. So what you do is you're saying that minorities who now have a very strong voice that is heard by two members of the United States Congress in two congressional districts would in fact be diminished, regardless of how you slice it up, if you were to put them all into one urban area. And I think the reality, too, is that you also are going to, if you're going to combine in both urban areas, which are very different, and again, the older suburbs that surround these cities are more urban than they are suburban, and their voice is much more logically heard the way it is. It's not about having two members of Congress representing two cities, that sort of stuff. It's really about the logic of the entire map of the state of Minnesota. And I think that the folks who put this map together in 1990 and in 1980 actually did a very good job of looking at the demographics of the state of Minnesota, where we have 8 congressional districts, where we have 4 that are primarily rural with some suburbs. Mr. Kennedy comes from a suburb, for example, the new member of Congress from the 2nd Congressional District. We have 2 rather large suburban areas that have diverse yet newer suburban constituencies. And we have 2 members of the United States Congress that both represent large urban areas that are very diverse with diverse suburbs surrounding them. And it's actually a very logical map. There's no question that Mr. Walsh or Mr. Ebensteiner or Mr. Erlinson and the wonderful folks who work for me at the DFL party could draw some very creative maps to make it, you know, six Republicans or six Democrats to two on the other side, if we wanted to be creative that way. It's really about the logic of what makes sense for the great state of Minnesota, and I actually think that the congressional map that exists today is one that makes sense, and it's one that's very competitive. I mean, we've had the first and second congressional districts just in the last 10, 11 years switch from Democrat to Republican. The second's gone from Republican to Democrat back to Republican. The seventh congressional district is no question a battleground. It's represented by a Democrat today, but one that's a very conservative Democrat. The sixth district is certainly a competitive district, as well as the fourth congressional district, and the ever-changing there. So what you have is you have a number of competitive congressional districts in the state of Minnesota, which is one of the things that we sort of hope for when we look at redistricting, regardless of whether we're partisan as Democrats or Republicans.
Mr. Erlinson, I'm going to cut you off for just a moment. Quick
sure.
comment from Mr. Walsh, and then I'd like to get some callers before we hear from President Bush in a little bit.
Well, Mike, it's a great map in 1991, but I don't know how you can defend the map today when the 6th District has 106,000 too many people. The map
you just make slight modifications, and we have a
slight modifications. The growth in population has brought 45% of the people to the suburban ring, and you're saying it's okay if only two people represent them. It's out of whack and needs to be fixed.
If you want to, I mean,
I'm going to cut you off for just a minute because I really would like to hear from a couple of our callers because our time is going to be short this morning.
Okay.
Mary from St. Paul is on the line right now. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. This is Mary, and I live in St. Paul. And actually, I have a question but also a comment. It amazes me that the Republicans think that if you combine these two districts, it gives a stronger voice to minorities and to women. Because what about opportunities for election? It means that, you know, we had the first woman in 50 years elected now. And it seems to me, and what I'm hearing, at least in St. Paul, is that people want more opportunities, not less opportunities for minorities and women to be elected. And I'd like for the people to address that.
All right. Thanks very much, Mary.
The redistricting really has nothing to do with women or men, and it has nothing to do with Representative McCollum being in office. And as far as minorities are concerned, if we believe, and I think we do in Minnesota, that minorities, at least blacks, vote as a block, mostly Democratic, and certainly they do nationwide, and you've got 100,000 black votes in this new district in Minneapolis and St. Paul, certainly they can have a larger impact. For instance, in a Democrat primary, in a DFL primary, where vote turnout is a little bit lower than the general election, and you can have a huge impact on a DFL primary and therefore on the eventual congressman that gets there. I just think putting minority groups together, and the courts think this too, you should maximize opportunities for minorities to get elected.
Mr. Erlinson?
Well, I mean, I guess the way the bill says it, I guess I could probably say the same comment that he said to me, which let's just shove all the minorities together in one congressional district, or maybe we should shove all of the women into one congressional district too. I mean, you know, Mary had a very good point here that one of the things that the DFL party has prided itself on is promoting minorities for elected office and promoting women. We are very proud of our new congresswoman from the 4th Congressional District, Betty McCollum, who, as I said before and continue to say, is a very good representative both for urban and suburban area and will be a good representative regardless of what congressional district ultimately she lives in after redistricting. What's that?
You're going to make her job harder if she now has to represent Frogtown and Woodbury along with Frogtown and North Oaks. It's just you're going to exacerbate the problem she has in making decisions every day about which part of her constituent she's going to represent.
Well, isn't that just sort of the way it has to be?
I think the one thing Bill seems to be talking about, too, this is, I mean, if we want to just talk about partisan maps, I mean, we could do that. This is not about partisan maps. This is, I mean, you know, we could have that fight. That fight is not going to lead us down any road that's going to result in the legislature doing its job. We have Democrats in control of one body, Republicans in control of the other. We have five members of the Congress in Washington today that are Democrats, and we have three that are Republicans. The ultimate ability to us to have and do our job as people that represent political parties and our members of Congress and our state legislators is that people work together to design a map that, A, has competitive districts, and B has the voice of the people of Minnesota that are being heard. Those voices are being heard today by good members of the United States Congress. The districts should be competitive. Betty McCollum is not lobbying at the Capitol to say, hey, you know, you need to make my district as safer, and I doubt that Mr. Gutnick or Mr. Kennedy are doing the same thing.
Next caller is Kevin from Brooklyn Park. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. So I just wanted to comment. This whole plan from Mr. Walsh here is so blatantly self-interested for the GOP, it's almost laughable. The GOP in this state, just like the National Party, seems to think that if we put a sign up that says, don't look here, we won't look here. All this is kind of one of the reasons I left the GOP about 10 years ago and won't be back. Thank you.
Okay, Kevin, thanks for the call. I guess the underlying point here is that the assumption is that if you create a suburban district, it's going to vote Republican. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, it's a big assumption. I mean, this is not about partisanship. This is about logic.
It's not about partisanship?
No,
really?
It's about logic. You know, the same fight we had in 1980 in this state, there were five congressional districts for rural Minnesota. And the numbers, the demographics, forced that to go from five until four in 1981. It's change is hard, and this is change. But we don't get to pick by partisanship how the districts fall. They have to be 614,900 voters, and it's just logical that when you have 45% of the state's population living in the suburbs, you need more suburban congressional representation. One way to do that is to combine the two core cities. So you can argue whether it'll help Republicans or Democrats by creating more suburban districts, but this is a shift that has occurred in the population, and the plan just has to recognize that.
Mr. Erlinson.
Well, the plan will recognize that because the suburban voters are going to be represented by members of Congress as they are today in the year 2002 after the elections. And so I think one of the things that we've seen, which is good for the DFL party, Al Gore did substantially better than Bill Clinton in either one of his two victorious elections in winning votes in the suburban area. We've seen suburban areas become more Democratic, I think partially because the issues of the Democratic Party has fought for harder: education, gun safety, not gun control, but gun safety, economic security for not only seniors, but again, women and minorities, is something that the suburbs are becoming much more diverse. I would find that, you know, again, if the minority population of Minneapolis and St. Paul is certainly not all clustered in the core cities as well. They're growing into the suburbs just like all populations. We have a diverse state. I'm not worried today about how we draw the lines as far as the makeup of whether the DFL party can win elections in the suburbs or in the urban areas. There will be competitive all over the state of Minnesota. I think the question is, do we want to gerrymander our congressional districts and throw it all out and start over? And I think that if the legislature wants to make those arguments, they may very well do it. But the logic of that doesn't lead us down a path that gets us there. So the question is, if we want to quickly move the debate today to how do we make changes to the existing congressional districts in a way that is logical for the state of Minnesota and ultimately represents the voice of the constituents in the urban, suburban, and rural areas fairly.
This is Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Melanie Summers, sitting in today for Catherine Lanfer. We are talking with Mike Erlinson, the chair of the DFL party in Minnesota, who is joining us by phone from Washington, D.C., and Bill Walsh, the state Republican Party's communications director. We're talking about congressional redistricting in the wake of the census numbers yesterday, which showed a great population increase in the suburban and ex-urban areas around the Twin Cities, lesser population increase in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We'd like to remind you that President Bush is going to be having a news conference in just a few moments or so, standing by. It should be in the next few minutes, so we will carry that when the president begins speaking. He's expected to talk some about the budget plan and then take questions from reporters, so we'll join that as soon as it begins. So in the meantime, we'll continue our conversation for a few more minutes and welcome Randy from Morris into the conversation. Good morning, Randy.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to comment on the reason I see as the shift of population to suburban areas. I'm a 23-year-old college graduate, and the jobs are down there. So what we have is a shift of this population to down to this area, and I'm quite put out by the Republicans' mentality to say that, well, we should let that dominate the process, dominate the discussion, and to say this is an agricultural state. Minnesota is an ag-based state, and to look and let this shift dominate the process, and let rural Minnesota lose a voice, let urban lose a voice. I just don't understand that. Why do we want this process to shift suburban? I don't agree with that. Why should Minnesota become a suburban state? I grew up on a farm. This is a farm state, as far as I'm concerned. And to say that we should just let the suburbs dominate the whole process, I just don't agree with that. And I think, you know, whether or not it all pans out, Mr. Erlinson made a good point. The suburbs, the DFL is becoming more competitive in the suburban areas. So to say that, well, we're going to just create three solid Republican districts, I don't understand that mentality.
Randy, we're going to have to let you go for time reasons. I'll just point out that according to the census figures yesterday, 45% of the population now of Minnesota is within that 11 counties surrounding the Twin Cities metro area, 55% in what we call outstate Minnesota.
Outstate plus Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Plus Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'm sorry. Mr. Welsh, would you like to respond to Randy's question?
Well, we don't have any choice. The Supreme Court and the courts, the federal courts, have said that congressional districts have to be equal as practicable, which means equal, which means almost exactly equal, and they each have to have 614,900 votes. So, you know, we can talk about, you know, how much we want to keep rural Minnesota together or keep a voice in the urban area. The demographics are driving this discussion, and there's this nasty little principle in America called, well, one person, one vote, and this Constitution that keeps getting in the way of all these great ideas we have, but we have to respect that. The courts require us to do that, and that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about partisanship or creating three Republican suburban districts. We don't even have that now. One of the suburban districts is represented by a Democrat. We're talking about recognizing the reality and the demographic shift in the new map.
Very quick comment from Mr. Erlinson.
Well, you know, I mean, I think if we wanted to take that to the next level, you could just take Minnesota, which they talked about 20 years ago, make it a pie shape. Make every single member of the United States Congress represent urban, suburban, and rural. Again, not necessarily a very logical way to do it. That's why I think if you look at the map that exists today, it's a pretty logical map. You get suburban people having a voice in the urban areas as well as the rural areas. That makes the state that much more diverse, the way we have the sort of suburban ring around the urban area. I think it's a good map that the voice of Minnesota is represented well.
We're going to be probably joining President Bush's news conference in just a minute or two, but he's walking up to the podium, so I think we will need to cut short our conversation with Bill Walsh from the Republican Party and Mike Erlinson of the DFL Party. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us, and now we're going to join President George W. Bush at a news conference.
I'm pleased I am that the House yesterday passed on a realistic, common-sense budget to the Senate. I appreciated the vote. They did the right thing. It's a budget that meets our nation's priorities. It's also a budget that leaves ample room for meaningful, real, long-lasting tax relief. I look forward to working with the Senate to get a budget passed. I'm also deeply concerned about the escalating violence in the Middle East. It is claiming the lives of innocent civilians on both sides. The tragic cycle of incitement, provocation, and violence has gone on far too long. Both sides must take important steps to calm the situation now. The Palestinian Authority should speak out publicly and forcibly in a language that the Palestinian people to condemn violence and terrorism. It should arrest those who perpetrated the terrorist acts. It should resume security cooperation with Israel. The government of Israel, for its part, should exercise restraint in its military response. It should take steps to restore normalcy to the lives of the Palestinian people by easing closures and removing checkpoints. Last week, Prime Minister Sharon assured me that his government wants to move in this direction, and I urge Israel to do so. I will be meeting with Egypt's President Mubarak next Monday and Jordan's King Abdullah the week after to seek their help in defusing the tensions. Egypt and Jordan are two of our most important partners in the region, and their role is crucial. I have asked Secretary Powell to call Chairman Arafat today and contact other leaders to urge them to stand against violence. Our diplomats in the region are fully engaged in this effort. Our goal is to encourage a series of reciprocal and parallel steps by both sides that will halt the escalation of violence, provide safety and security for civilians on both sides, and restore normalcy to the lives of everyone in the region. A lasting peace in the region will come only when the parties agree directly on its terms. This week I vetoed an unbalanced UN resolution because it tried to force the adoption of a mechanism on which both parties did not agree. My approach will be to facilitate the party's work in finding their own solution to peace. We seek to build a stable foundation for restoring confidence, rebuilding security cooperation, and resuming a political dialogue between the parties. Be glad to answer some questions. Ron.
The Senate, as you know, is finishing up legislation to ban all soft money. What do you think of the bill, particularly the ban on individual contributions that you forcefully opposed in the campaign? Specifically, sir, would you sign it?
This is a bill in progress. It's a bill that continues to change. And I'll take a look at it when it makes my desk. And if it improves the system, I'll sign it. I look forward to signing a good piece of legislation.
Could you sign a bill that bans individual soft money contributions?
I'll look at the whole bill, and I'll make my determination as to whether or not the bill improves the situation. And I appreciate the hard work that's being done on the legislation, and I'm going to wait until I see the final version. Yes, Helen.
Is your administration reviewing USAID to Russia to stop the spread of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons? Are you considering reducing that aid, and if so, why?
Well, we're reviewing all programs, those related to de-escalating potential nuclear problems. We want to make sure that any money that is being spent is being spent in an effective way. I have the obligation to the taxpayers to make sure that the money, for example, going to the Russian program, part of Nunn-Lugar, for example, is effective. And so we're putting a full review on the programs. And we fully intend to continue to cooperate with the Russians. It's in our nation's best interest to work with Russia to dismantle its nuclear arsenal. I was pleased to see that Senator Nunn, one of the authors of the Nunn-Lugar bill, agreed with our approach to take a look to make sure the programs are efficient, and we will continue to do so. Helen.
President, in the last few weeks you have rolled back health and safety and environmental measures proposed by the last administration and other previous administrations. This has been widely interpreted as a payback time to your corporate donors. Are they more important than the American people's health and safety? And what else do you plan to repeal?
Well, Helen, I told people pretty plainly that I was going to review all the last-minute decisions that my predecessor had made. And that is exactly what we're doing. I presume you're referring to the decision on arsenic and water. First of all, there had been no change in the arsenic, accepted arsenic level in water since the 40s. And at the very last minute, my predecessor made a decision. And we pulled back his decision so that we can make a decision based upon sound science and what's realistic. There will be a reduction in the acceptable amount of arsenic per billion after the review in the EPA.
How about stopping the black lung benefits for families? And this is sort of to increase some of the benefits of these minors.
We will work with members of the delegation to make sure people are properly treated. But ours is going to be a administration that makes decisions on science, what's realistic, common sense decisions. For example, circumstances have changed since the campaign. We're now in an energy crisis, and that's why I decided to not have mandatory caps on CO2, because in order to meet those caps, our nation would have had to have had a lot of natural gas immediately flow into the system, which is impossible. We don't have the infrastructure able to move natural gas. We need to have an active exploration program. One of the big debates that's taking place in the Congress, or will take place in the Congress, is whether or not we should be exploring for natural gas in Alaska, for example, in Anwar. I strongly think we should, in order to make sure that we've got enough gas to be able to help reduce greenhouse emissions in the country. You see, gas is clean, and yet there's not enough of it. And we got pipeline capacity problems in the country. We have an energy shortage. I look forward to explaining this today to the leader of Germany as to why I made the decision I made. We'll be working with Germany. We'll be working with our allies to reduce greenhouse gases, but I will not accept a plan that'll harm our economy and hurt American workers. John.
Mr. President, new figures out today show that the economy grew at an annual rate of 1% in the last 3 months of the year 2000. My question to you, sir, is what are you prepared to do to immediately stimulate the economy? Because it would appear that your long-term tax package does not do it, yet you dismiss out of hand attempts from the Hill to give back a rebate of some $60 billion this year, unless it's tied to longer-term tax relief. Why can you not sign a short-term package and then pursue your long-term package separate to that?
Well, John, first of all, I support the efforts on the Hill to provide immediate tax relief. I've been calling for immediate tax relief. I think it makes sense to do so. But we've got to have long-term relief as well. Part of building confidence in our economy is not only to give the consumers a boost, but to have a plan that reduces rates for the long term so that people who make investments, the small business owners, the entrepreneurs, will have certainty that the cash flows of the future will be enhanced so they can expand their job base and make new capital purchases. I appreciate very much what the leadership and the Senate have, Tom Daschle, for example, talked about immediate tax relief or immediate rebates plus reducing rates permanently. You just need to reduce more rates than the ones he suggested. There's a debate going on here in Washington, and it's really, do you want to increase the size of the federal government, or do you want to give let people keep their own money? And it's there's a philosophical divide, and I'm going to continue to stand on the side of the people and make it as clear as I can that we've met our priorities in the budget I submitted. And it's not only good for the economy, though, to give people their money back, it's good for working families so they can have more money to manage their own accounts. There's a lot of focus about national debt in Washington. But it's important for Congress not to forget a lot of folks have got consumer debt as well. And when you couple high energy prices with consumer debt, a lot of folks are in a squeeze. And I look forward to continuing to make the case.
But as this debate continues, consumers are not seeing any more money back in their pockets.
Well, that's exactly right. And you've got a good point. Consumers haven't seen any money back in their pockets. That's why it's important for the Senate to act quickly on the budget. I hope there's no delay next week. When it comes to the budget considerations, I look forward to working with both House members and Senate members once the budgets have been passed to get tax relief enacted quickly and to get money as quickly as possible into the people's pockets.
Yes. Mr. President,
Gregory.
You're no longer negotiating with yourself on tax cuts. There are a lot of other approaches that are out there. Why not say today exactly what you're willing to do to appease both moderate Republicans and Democrats who fear that those projected budget surpluses won't materialize and they want some way to cut off a tax cut, if that's the case, if we can't afford it. What will you do?
Well, listen, I'm anxious to talk to members of the Senate about the so-called look-back provisions. But I'm going to remind people that one way budget surpluses will not materialize is if Congress overspends. And so any look-back procedure has got to make sure that there are restraints to government spending. The surest way to eat up the surplus is to have the kind of spending that took place during the last fiscal year when the discretionary spending increased by 8%. And by the way, I'm still negotiating with myself.
I get
a suggestion from here and a suggestion from there. So-and-so suggests something. And good Americans such as yourself are trying to get me to negotiate with myself. Yes, you may.
Let me just bring up another suggestion.
another chance to negotiate with myself?
Will you sign or veto tax cuts that exceed $1.6 trillion, even if that increase would result from an immediate stimulus to the economy this year?
David, I hope that Congress does not diminish the size of the tax relief package that I've sent up there, nor increase the size of the tax relief package I set up there. The 1.6 is the size that I think is right. And we've had a lot of discussion here in Washington about whether it's too big or too small. Nothing has changed my opinion as to whether or not about the size of the package I sent. It's the right size. Don't worry about the beeper violation. Okay. It's a new approach. Gordon taught me a lesson.
On the Middle East, for a couple of months, both you and officials in your administration have indicated you wanted to step back from constant involvement of the U.S. and the president in the conflict and in the peace process. Was that a mistake, given the escalation in both violence and the rhetoric over there? And is what you're doing today essentially an admission that the involvement of the United States and the President of the United States publicly and personally is necessary for the parties to do that?
Terry, I have said all along that this nation will not try to force a peace settlement in the Middle East, that we will facilitate a peace settlement. It requires two willing parties to come to the table to enact a peace treaty that will last. And this administration won't try to force peace on the parties. That's what the UN tried to do the other day. They tried to force a situation in the Middle East that to which both parties did not agree. That's why I vetoed their suggestion. We have been fully engaged in the Middle East. We're on the phone all the time to the leaders. I'm welcoming leaders to come. In order for there to be a peace, this country must develop what I call a broad foundation for peace. That means we've got to have good, strong relations with the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Saudis. As you may remember, Secretary of State went to Syria to sit down with Bashar. And we got a lot of work to do in order to build that foundation for peace, but we're going to make a full-time effort to do so. But our fellow citizens have got to realize that in order for there to be the peace, there has to be two willing parties. And we will continue to try to convince the parties to become willing to sit down and negotiate a lasting peace. But this country cannot impose a timetable nor a settlement on the parties if they're unwilling to accept it.
Really, to contain the violence, sir, do you personally need to get more involved? Is that what you're doing today?
I am involved on the telephone. I met with Prime Minister Sharon. I'm talking to our allies and friends in the Middle East. I've instructed the Secretary of State to call Mr. Arafat. And implicit in your question is the first step, and that is the violence must cease in order for there to be any meaningful dialogue in the Middle East. And so we're in the process of trying to bring calm to the region, and it's going to require more than just one voice. Obviously, our voice is an important voice for bringing calm to the Middle East, so are other nations. And I look forward to visiting with President Mubarak and King Abdullah to lend to rally them to try to convince, particularly in their case, Mr. Arafat to speak out against violence in a language that the Palestinians can understand.
President.
Major.
You have mentioned today that there is an energy crisis, and
yes.
Yet the budget resolutions that have passed the House and are due to be considered in the Senate next week do not include any revenue from the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I've talked to the people who made that decision, and they said it is a political fight they believe unwinnable, that you could not, nor could they, create the majorities in either the House or the Senate to bring about drilling in Anwar, your number one solution, or one of the top solutions to dealing with the energy crisis. Does this not represent a rejection from your own party of dealing with the energy situation?
Well, Major, first of all, there are other areas in the United States on which we can find natural gas. I think it's important for us to open up Anwar. Whether or not the Congress sees it that way is another matter. But that's not going to deter me from having, for example, the Interior Secretary look at all lands that are not, you know, not to be fully protected for exploration. We've got a plan to make sure that gas comes flows freely out of Canada into the United States. I talked to the Prime Minister about that. What I find interesting is that I think we had meaningful discussions about exploration in the Northwest Territories. Right across the line, admittedly miles away, is Anwar. But nevertheless, there's a big, vast region of natural gas, and it's important for us to explore and encourage exploration and work with the Canadians to get pipelines coming out of the Northwest Territories to the United States. I've talked to the President of Mexico about a policy. There are going to be a lot of areas where we can find natural gas in America other than Anwar. It'd be helpful if we opened up Anwar. I think it's a mistake not to. And I would urge you all to travel up there and take a look at it. And you can make, let me finish, please. And you can make the determination as to how beautiful that country is. Yes, Aunt Major.
If the American people looking to you to deal with the energy crisis, and you cannot look to your own party to deal with what you and your own advisors have said is a crucial area in which to explore. How can the American public have confidence in your ability to deal with Congress to address the situation you have called today?
There's a lot of other areas we can explore, Major, and one of them is to work with the Canadians. There's gas in our hemisphere, and the fundamental question is, where is it going to come from? I'd like it to be American gas. But if the Congress decides not to have for exploration in Anwar, we'll work with the Canadians. I'm interested in getting more energy supply so that businesses can grow and people can heat their homes. We got a shortage of energy in America. And it doesn't matter to me where the gas comes from. In the long run, just so long as we get gas moving into the country, so long as we increase supply of natural gas. And we also need to have clean coal technologies as well. And we need a full affront on a energy crisis that is real in California and looms for other parts of our country if we don't move quickly.
Mr. President, as I'm sure you've been aware, there are stories consistently about tensions, persistent tensions between you and Senator John McCain dating back to your rivalry in the primaries. I wonder if you could address that, not just on the campaign finance reform bill, but also on the Patient's Bill of Rights, which McCain's supporters believe you don't want to sign a Patient's Bill of Rights with McCain's name on it.
Well, look, this is Washington, D.C. gossip, is how I view it. I mean, I respect John McCain. I like him a lot. That doesn't mean we're going to agree 100% of the time. I mean, we got some differences. That's what the primary was all about, airing our differences. But I respect John, and this, it's a game in Washington to try to create tension between John McCain and me. And I'm not going to let it happen. Now, I can't control the stories that seem to be popping up all the time and kind of the faceless aides that are out there trying to stir the pot. I can just give you my perspective. I like him. He's a good man. We have some differences. And I will, I think the idea, for example, of having a $5 million cap on punitive damages is just not the right public policy. But that shouldn't surprise you. After all, I signed a bill in the state of Texas with a $750,000 cap on punitive damages. But that's nothing personal, it's just a difference of opinion. And the idea of the president laying out, a framework for debate and some guidelines is perfectly acceptable practice in Washington, D.C., yeah.
Just follow on that. When you sent the signal, and your aides did, to Congress that they could not count on you to veto a campaign finance reform bill, what message were you sending? A lot of people interpret it that you're saying to Congress, if you don't like it, kill it, because I won't.
No, I look forward to signing a bill that makes the process better. Sometimes the legislators will say, oh, don't worry, we've got the president. Not sure exactly what that means, except if a bill improves the system, makes it to my desk, I'll be inclined to sign. I, of course, reserve all options. The bills are forever changing, as those who follow the process know. But I'm going to... I will make my decision once the bill makes it to my desk.
Why is it that you have not decided to invite Yasser Arafat here? Have you concluded that he's part of the problem, not part of the solution?
Well, we're going to work with all parties. As I mentioned, the Secretary of State is calling Chairman Arafat today to urge him to stop the violence and call upon those over whom he's got influence to stop the violence. And I've got quite a crowded calendar of leaders who are coming to see me, and I'm looking forward to visiting with President Mubarak and King Abdullah. Mike.
Mr. President,
can I follow
suit?
No. Just teasing. Go ahead. Just testing. You did. The signal I'm sending to the Palestinians is stop the violence. And that I can't make it any more clear. And I hope that Chairman Arafat hears it loud and clear. He's going to hear it again on the telephone today. This is not the first time the message has been delivered. It's so important in order for there to begin any kind of discussion about peace that we stop the violence in the Middle East. Mike.
President, allies of the United States have complained that you haven't consulted them sufficiently on your stance toward negotiations with North Korea, Kyoto Treaty, your deteriorating relations elsewhere. You read the international press, it looks like everyone's mad at us. Mr. President, how do you think that came to be, and what, if anything, do you plan to do about it?
Well, I get a completely different picture, of course, when I sit down with the world leaders. I'm looking forward to sitting down with Mr. Schroeder here in about 30 minutes. I've had very honest and straightforward visits with many of the world's leaders. And there were some concerns initially because they didn't know me. And they heard all kinds of rumors about what our administration would be about. And I now have the chance to sit down and talk to them face to face. And I'm a pretty straightforward fellow, Mike. And if I don't mind making my case, and it's important. It's important for world leaders to know exactly where the United States is coming from. On missile defense, for example, I've assured our allies that we will consult with them. But we're moving forward to develop systems that reflect the threats of today. I mean, who knows where the next terrorist attack is going to come from, but we better be ready for it. And I believe I've got the opportunity to convince our friends and allies that our vision makes sense. It brings a lot of common sense to an old, stale debate, the old arms control debate. In terms of the CO2 issue, I will explain as clearly as I can today and every other chance I get that we will not do anything that harms our economy. Because first things first are the people who live in America. That's my priority. And I'm worried about the economy. I'm worried about the lack of an energy policy. I'm worried about rolling blackouts in California. It's in our national interests that we have develop a strong energy policy with realistic common sense environmental policy. And I'm going to explain that to our friends. And it's in their interest, by the way, that our economy remains strong. After all, we're a free trading administration. We trade with each other. And people are beginning to learn what my administration is like. And they're going to find we're steadfast friends. But a friend is somebody who's willing to tell the truth. And if there's a disagreement, to be able to state it clearly, to make it clear where we disagree. But for those who worry about our willingness to consult, they shouldn't worry. We are. We're going to be open-minded, and we'll have open dialogue. Yes, sir.
Mr. President, you gave me the floor.
Okay, you're next.
Thank you, sir. Mr. President,
Next to next.
Clarify.
Let me rephrase it. You're last.
No problem.
We're used to it. Clarify on tax cuts.
Yes.
I wanted to clarify the linkage that you feel is necessary. You have said that you want to have a tax cut rate reduction, and you also support the efforts to try to do a quick retroactive tax cut. When you speak of those two things, will you insist upon one package of bills that includes the rate reduction and any kind of quick short-term stimulus, or would you accept some kind of verifiable promise that they'll get to your tax cuts later?
That's the old trust me?
Yeah.
Look, I,